This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Private Eyes and Underworlds, Crime Meets Urban Fantasy. And this week, we're very pleased to welcome Laura Lapso, who is the author of a book that has just been released recently. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, we're really, really happy to have you here. Laura, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about your book?
I'm a Finn who migrated to England 15 years ago and has never really got around to going home, much to the dismay of my mum, who keeps dropping hints that are sized like anvils. I've been writing more seriously for about 4.5 years now, and my debut novel, Fallible Justice, was published last week on Thursday. It starts my Wild Investigation series, which is set in modern-day London, but with magic, murder and general mayhem.
Yeah. Fantastic. Those things go hand in hand.
I agree.
Now, I was lucky enough to get an advance review copy of the book. I think this is in part because I know Louise Walters a little bit, because we've attended a few of the same festivals of writing. So while I don't know her well, she saw me on Twitter and said, oh, do you fancy an art copy? And I'm like, you want to give me a free book? I'm totally down with that. And I loved the book. It was so different. It has a slightly literary feel to it, which is unusual in something that you might class as urban fantasy. But then it's also crime. It sort of follows a lot of the beats of police procedurals, for example, and mystery novels. So it wasn't really quite like anything I'd read before.
I liked a bit different and usually awkward too.
Yeah, it was a really, really enjoyable read. And the main character as well. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about your main character.
Yania is one of the wild folk who are these people who can channel all of nature. So what they do is to see better, they borrow the sight of a red kite, or if they need to smell better, they might borrow the nose of a bloodhound. Anything really that's nearby, as a general rule. And they can, when they're in a wild setting, they draw the power from all around them. And then Yania has chosen to live in the city, which means that she's living off her inner magic reserves and struggling a lot, which is one of the themes in the book, is how do you adapt to an environment that goes against everything that that you've brought up to be in, while at the same time trying to find your place in the world?
Yeah.
And why, this is, sorry, an interesting question, but why is she in the city? Is this self-imposed?
The exile is self-imposed, yes. Yeah, she has lots of reasons. Some of them come up in the first book, some of them don't. But essentially what she's trying to do is trying to figure out who she could be when taken out of the context of the conclave where she grew up.
Yeah, because right. the conclave itself is quite an exclusive social, well, constructed society, isn't it? They like to keep themselves to themselves, and there's something a bit stifling about it as well.
Yes, yeah, and also it's very much the elderman's word is the law, and obviously the elderman is always a man, and women conform, and it's not quite so bad. I make it sound worse than it actually is, but their whole way of life is built upon the idea that the elderman knows the best and what he says goes, and Yania doesn't really like that.
Yeah. And also the idea of, you know, we must keep our magic, if you like, pure and pass it on to future generations.
Mm.
Without giving too much away.
Great. I really, really want to read this now.
There are other things that are quite interesting about Yania as well. One that struck me as someone who is a chronic pain sufferer was that you had her suffer chronic pain.
Yes. Yeah. From very early on, I wanted her to have a complication that no amount of magic could fix. And that has kind of become, in some ways, again, it's a kind of longer term theme, is that there are things that no amount of power can solve, and how do you actually live with that?
Yeah.
And for her, it's almost twice as hard, because the conclave doesn't believe in any medical cures that aren't, that don't come straight directly from nature. So she could, the only thing, the only pain relief she could have back home were herbal things, which aren't, don't really cut it with severe chronic pain. So that's another reason why she left. But for me, it was important to have that experience of pain relayed to the readers without that being the focal point of the story. So
Yeah.
it's she manages a condition, it's always there, but that's not who she is.
Yeah, and I think it's touches like that that give you a really well-rounded character. For example, obviously a character's, for lack of a better word, disability or a character's sexuality doesn't define the character, but it's good to have those things having been considered. It means you really obviously thought about your character, etc. And yeah, it's nice for people who it's nice for people who do suffer from chronic pain to see themselves represented in books without it being the focal point of the book.
Yeah, and I for me, because I suffer from a related condition to what Yania has, so I found that it was always selfish putting that in, because it allowed me to actually explain what it's like living with that pain in a way that if I sat face to face with someone, I wouldn't be able to put that in words.
Yeah, I think fiction can sometimes make it a lot more palatable, or it can open the way for those sort of discussions, can't it?
Oddly enough, I think it's not just always fiction that does that, but actually, fantasy in general seems to be a good conduit for discussing very real life problems, and it's almost like it's much easier to talk about. Things like pain and disability and things like that within magical worlds. Maybe because there's this, it kind of evens things out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Yes, I think so.
I think so. I mean, we've talked before about how fantasy can give you the problem that you're facing reflected back to you in a way that you can actually solve on a, if you like, on a purely mental level, because you engage with the character within the fantasy or within the science fiction or whatever, and as they face their problems, you face your own. And I think it's those kind of parallels that allow readers to find themselves in fiction and you know, perhaps understand their own situation a bit better, even if, as you say, no magic in the world can actually solve it.
Yeah, and I think it also helps that when you do have the magical power, perhaps that allows you to flourish on a different level, and almost not sets the pain aside, but that isn't all that defines you.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so Yania is a private investigator in London, and you've got Old London and New London. So, what was it that drew you to creating this, I suppose, like a sub-world, if you like, of London as we know it?
I like the idea of having some kind of defined borders for where the magical people live, because like any minority society, there's strength in numbers and comfort in people who understand what life is like for you and what it's like having magic. And I mean, a lot of what happened to Infallible Justice came about just as random snippets and ideas that flooded my brain as I was doing the planning. But I had this idea of being able to stand on a street and you see these signs advertising potions and another one for like a spell casting class. And if you squint and the world a little bit shifts, suddenly it's gym posters and fast food restaurants.
Yeah.
And it just fascinated me that this kind of, particularly in the borders, there's this constant struggle between the magic and the mundane.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, Yeni, as a private investigator, is really mostly looking at the more magical problems rather than tracking down people's missing cats and things.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Her special power of being able to detect different magic users and identify them lends herself way better to solving magical problems than looking for someone's missing cat.
Yes.
No, but that's not important.
Well, no, obviously.
Sorry. I'm just thinking also of the Dresden Files, because I'm pretty sure that's exactly what he ends up doing at one point.
Really?
Finds a missing cat, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a dog or something like that, but I think there are, like, maybe zombies involved. I can't remember.
So business is really slow for Harry Dresden, then.
I just want to make a, you know, point something out, which is that it's really interesting. You've obviously set it in London. Now, obviously, it's a different version of London. But I really like that, because a lot of urban fantasy is obviously set in the very nitty gritty of New York or Chicago or Los Angeles. I think there's also another reason why we have a lot of that is that you do have this relationship between crime and urban fantasy. And when we think of crime, you know, you want to have the guns, you want to have the gangsters, you want to have those kinds of, you know, those undercurrents, because it's very, oddly enough, it's really influenced by noir kind of, by the noir genre, if you get my meaning. Mm. So it's actually really nice to see it done in London. And I say that like I'm also patting myself on the back, because obviously the urban fantasy series I'm writing is also set in London. But that's only because I have pretty much know nothing about America, and London was closer. So that was my excuse. But I do like it specifically because obviously with yours, you do have that relationship with crime and investigation. And obviously the whole PI shtick, it's very much associated with America, but actually really realistically the first kind of independent detective that we really get in fiction that's very noteworthy is obviously Sherlock Holmes, who's in London. So I just want to ask, how did you find the experience of writing a kind of a crime investigative urban fantasy set in London? Do you feel restrained by the fact that, you know, you couldn't have people toting guns, or was it actually okay because a lot of the problems were magic, so there were magic, there was magic kind of weaponry, magic antagonism, magic solutions?
I found it okay, actually, and one of the reasons why I did set Fallible Justice and the whole series in London was because I've tried to write a book set in Chicago before, and I really struggled to do it with The Lonely Planet Guide. And with London, I can jump on the train and I'll be there in 25 minutes. So it made the research really easy. But I wanted, with the series and the crimes, I didn't really want the focus to be the action and the big fight scenes. It was more about the characters and the process of solving the crime. And for enough, in the second book, you do see a gun. It does make an appearance, but not in a way that you might expect. So there is that, but I like more. I don't want to spend 50 pages describing a fight scene because I get bored writing it and I'd get bored reading it. So my focus is elsewhere.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I like mystery to be clever with plenty of twists and lots of things to occupy my brain as I'm going along. I don't necessarily want, as you say, a 50-page fight scene. fight scenes should really be short, sharp, and to the point, in my opinion. So, we sort of talked around the edges a bit. Can you give us a rough, no spoilers, synopsis, if you like, of exactly what our readers who can expect from the first book?
In the magic in the old London, where magical races coexist peacefully with humans, heralds of justice deliver verdicts that are considered infallible. And when a man is convicted of killing a fellow mage and sentenced to death, his daughter turns to Yanir Wild to prove her father's innocence. And she has just 4 days before the sentence is carried out to not just prove that he's innocent or whether he's innocent, but also how a herald of justice could be fooled. And she's helped in the task by her newly appointed apprentice, Carrion, who's a bird shaman. And they get to interact with some interesting people, like a grumpy cat shaman and a trickster hearth spirit, and this elusive woman who appears to be an urban legend and who no one quite knows what she is.
Yeah, you've just like named about most of the things I really loved about the book. I really liked Carrion's relationship with Yanir. Carrion's sort of like her little apprentice, basically, Madeline.
Right.
But you'd love it. You'd love that relationship. I just know that you'd really enjoy that. But that's why I keep mentioning the book to you.
I get it. Jeez.
Read it so I can discuss it with someone. In case you're wondering whether it was completely self-serving to get you on the episode, Laura, then yes, you'd be right.
That's right. I would gladly talk about Carrion until we're all bored to tears. He's lovely.
I mean, I did like Wishhearth as well. Great character.
I have fun writing these people. They're all awesome.
That's a good point. Do you actually have a favourite character out of the ones you write?
Oh, you're not meant to ask that, because they get grumpy and then they won't talk to me ever again. I think more than having a favourite character, I like writing interactions. So I really love when Yanni and Carrion are together and they do their kind of light banter, let's get on and solve this case now, kind of stuff. And I also love writing Wishhearth and Lady Bergamon when they're together.
Yeah.
They don't get a lot of screen time, but when they do, it is lovely.
And were you influenced? Sorry, this is going to make it sound like this isn't a loaded question or anything like that. But what would you say were your influences when you were writing this series?
Do you mean in terms of other books or?
Yeah, book series. I mean, even music or anything like that. Did anything kind of prompt your ideas or obviously I'm not saying did you copy anything, I don't believe that for a second, but you know, was there anything that kind of prompted you in that direction, any kind of crime fiction or urban fantasy or anything like that which helped keep you motivated?
I've always been kind of, well, I've always admired Agatha Christie a great deal, and I love her books, and I've always thought that I could never be sneaky enough to write those twists.
Just very quickly, who Miss Marple or Poirot?
Both, but I have a soft spot for Miss Marple. She's awesome.
Okay. Oh, damn it!
We're one all on that conversation, Madeline.
Shut up.
We have a running tally as to who falls down on which side.
She I mean, was not the Poirot's mustache isn't kind of cool and all that, but.
You could stab people with
knitting
cool.
needles. Why wouldn't you? But yeah, the other thing that, because I've read quite a few of the Dresden Files, and I love the world building. I've always admired the way Jim Butcher has done them. But it irritates me to no end that Harry Dresden does nothing but stare at women's boobs. I will punch him a little bit.
We're completely on the same page.
So.
It's not Harry Dresden's fault that he's surrounded by, he's literally surrounded by boobs, okay? It's not his fault that they're just...
And the women keep appearing naked. They just magically go away.
It's not Harry Dresden's fault that he just, there's talking boobs everywhere he goes.
Yeah.
All these highly attractive women. I like to just imagine that it's just because, not because there are actually, he's surrounded by highly attractive women, but because because Harry Dresden just thinks that all women are beautiful. That's how I see
it. Except that in Summer Night there is that troll girl who I don't think he fancies at all, but she ends up dying, so it's all good. Only the beautiful women survive.
Only the pretty ones survive.
Yeah, no one's really old, no one's really fat, no one's a bit unfortunate looking.
And no one's gay.
Yeah, definitely no one's gay.
And if they are, they still want to get it on with Harry Dresden.
Yeah, even the gay joke in it, which, to be honest, I laughed so hard at, which is Butters talking to Harry and saying, well, you know, I didn't realise you were gay, though, but, you know, after seeing him, I'm not surprised. He's talking about Thomas, and Harry's just there like, what? No, wait, he's my... And Thomas just leans in and gives him this chaste kiss on the forehead and says, I'll just be in the other room, babe, or something like that.
Yeah. See, I laughed at that, but at the same time I thought, oh, God, Butcher, was that seriously the best you could do?
I loved it, though. I loved it. But yeah, if all we can get is I've been mistaken for a couple with my brother, then yeah, it would be nice for a little bit of more rep. Anyway, so Agatha Christie, fantastic, and Harry Dresden. Anything else?
I'm not. Well, a couple of role playing games that I played a few years back that were set in modern day, but with magic, like Shadowrun rules, but modern day, and the GM had a fantastic way of describing settings and really weaving the magic into the mundane. And I thought if I could find a fraction of that magic in my writing, that'd be quite good.
Now that's a great influence, something that you've actually kind of played through yourself.
Mm.
Definitely.
And it's it was interesting. One of my old role playing friends contacted me yesterday saying he'd finished the book and loved it and so on. He said you can see the role-playing influence in the characters in my narrative, so I think they've taught me to be quite sneaky now.
No, that's great. That's really nice. Okay, right, let's look a little bit more generally, and we will come back to Fallible Justice, but we'll look a bit more about sort of private investigators within sort of urban fantasy settings. We have mentioned Harry Dresden, but let's go back to Harry Dresden for the moment and ignore the talking boobs if possible.
At the end of the day, I do like Harry Dresden. It's a fault. It's a problem, but I do like him.
It's the history here is the fact that Madeline obviously discovered Harry Dresden at, was it quite a formative stage when you decided you wanted to start writing?
I discovered Harry Dresden. I must have been about 17, so I was just finished writing The Sons of Thestian, or I was writing The Sons of Thestian. But yeah, I was quite young.
And she persuaded me to try it, and I did. And of course, I came into it in my mid 30s with slightly more fixed worldview, shall we say. And I think the things that hit me were things that perhaps you hadn't noticed because you were just loving this story and the setting and everything.
Yeah, it was the first bit of urban fantasy, you know, that I'd ever read. And obviously, you know, I knew things like the Percy Jackson series and I knew Harry Potter, but I'd never read anything like this before. So it was my first real glimpse into the genre. So there were a lot of things that I just forgave and completely missed. Talking boobies being one of them. Also because, you know, I was like coming into my sexuality at that time and I had no problem with talking boobies. I was like, great.
Yeah, but even I was there kind of thinking, well, yeah, it's not that I object to that, but I don't actually catalogue people's body parts in my head.
Yeah.
Even if the girl's really attractive, I'm not there going, I'm breaking this down into giving each area a score.
Yeah. Yeah, as I said, I forgave a lot then, and as I've gotten older, you know, my opinion's changed. I do feel like Jim Butcher himself has also kind of developed his writing, and, you know, he's very conscious of things now, but he also, you know, has certain expectations to be met in his writing. So it meant that I fell in love with the series straight off the bat. Jules is a little bit more dubious about it.
I've really, really enjoyed about two-thirds of it. And I think the problem is I then came back to you with, you know, what the hell is this? And Madeline had this entire shatter glass thing where it's like, oh God, I didn't see any of that before.
Just let me live in ignorance, Joel.
So I ruined it.
Yeah, it was the surprising moment for me where Jules started reading Kestrel Song and she just went, you realise this is better than Harry Dresden? And I'm like, I don't understand how that can be possible, because Harry Dresden is the best thing in the entire world. And I still maintain it's not better. I think it's different and maybe suits some people's tastes more than others. But looking at Harry Dresden just as a character, he was really, really interesting. And I really, really did like the way that there was this marriage between the stereotypical tall, broody PI and the dorky wizard and all the magic. And, you know, I love that whole broody PI kind of archetype, but I can get bored of it very quickly. I mean, just ask my opinions on Batman. But if you then marrying it then to all that magic and that wonder and all the weirdness and the fact that Harry is a bit of a dork, I just thought he was a fantastic character. I really, really liked him.
He is a terrible private investigator, though. He goes in as a private investigator in the same way that, like, a wrestler is probably not a great kindergarten teacher. It's like everything is kind of force for force kind of thing.
Kick down the door. Draw your sword. It'll be fine.
We won't bother trying to knock and ask questions. We'll just go straight in with our blasting rod. And
look, I think he's just trying to make ends meet, Joel. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, he does get the job done. There's usually quite a lot of explosions in the process, a lot of boobies, and, you know, there's someone starts a fire. But he does get the job done.
But have you noticed he never eats or sleeps?
Yeah.
And even when he gets beaten up to within an inch of his life, he's still good to go. In more ways than one, sadly.
Nah, he does. He does eat and sleep, but yeah, it would be great. Well, I mean, I don't know, he does suffer some pretty nasty things during the series.
But he does kind of then, you know how we've said before that damage is accumulative, what with us both being martial artists.
Look, he's a wizard, he's fine.
I feel like we're treading on sacred territory here, Madeline.
No, I agree. He definitely takes a lot. Well, I mean, to say it's a bit unrealistic is a bit unfair, considering it is, you know, fantasy. He is a magical creature at the end of the day. He is a wizard. And they do heal quicker, and he does have kind of wizarding friends, and there are other, you know, things in play at the time. Would I like to see him reacting a little bit more realistically to some of the things that he goes through? Yes. But on the other side of that, considering the pace of the stories, you can sort of understand why there's just no time for it.
Yeah, and whatever else you may think of Harry Dresden, Butcher clearly hit a hot market there, because it's been amazingly successful. I don't think it's the best thing ever written. I don't think it's even the best urban fantasy, but it's some of the earliest example of that type of urban fantasy. So the author clearly knew what he was doing in that respect, and continues to provide what people largely want, I think. So what is it, and this is a general question, anyone hop in, what is it about this whole setup of a private investigator dealing perhaps with one foot in the human world and one foot in the world of magic that is so appealing?
I think it gives you more freedom as to what the character's going to do. Because if they were a police detective, they'd be bogged down by a lot of red tape and paperwork and things, which I definitely didn't want Yania to have to do. Yeah. And you can bend the rules when you're a PI, and you can toe on that edge of law and maybe break into people's homes and so on.
Well, I mean, you say you can. I mean, it's still definitely illegal. But
well, yeah, absolutely. But
But I suppose you're self-employed, and you're not actually going to lose your job. If you you might end up in prison, but
like, I think it's more to do with it does always interest me. It's like, yeah, because if you're a PR, you know you don't have to conform to certain standards. I'm like, considering what the police usually get up to and how much they can get away with, I feel like actually that's not true, but I do get exactly what you mean. There is an element of freedom. There's also the fact that PIs just cannot be held to account in the same way that the police can.
Yeah. And I think I know what you mean, Laura, in the sense of if you haven't got this massive organised body behind you, then you're less constrained.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. No, yeah.
And that also speeds up the fiction when, having interviewed a potential witness, you don't then have to go back and file the appropriate paperwork in triplicates and get it signed off and get the witness to sign copy and then someone misfiles it and you have to do it all again. And
yeah, basically there's no safeguarding bureaucracy behind it all.
Yeah, and honestly, who wants to read about bureaucracy?
It gives you more freedom as a writer because you don't have to know the police procedures of the country you're writing about or setting your story in.
Yeah, that definitely helps. Plus, I think we just kind of like vigilantism.
Yeah.
And actually, I think the reason why we like PIs and we like vigilantes and stuff like that actually stems from something much older. And it's actually, I think, comes from a period of time where they were publicly demonised in that this was, at best, they were corrupt. Sorry, at worst, they were corrupt and evil. At best, they were incompetent. And you see that in early TV shows and even early books. So, I mean, like, again, in Sherlock Holmes, the police are kind of incompetent. Even in early Batman, you know, they're incompetent and corrupt. And then there was this sudden shift where, I can't even remember what it was called, but there was a police drama that came out where it was suddenly the police were the heroes. And it was kind of meant to be propaganda, and it is tied with America. I think, you know, there are problems with the police everywhere around the world, in that as an institution, there is a history of corruption. Now, I'm just going to point out that I know policemen. I don't think they're all evil. Definitely not. I think there are a lot of fantastic, hardworking officers out there who do their absolute best and believe in what they're doing. But there are also bad people in positions of power. And what happens is that they're often kind of just ignored, and so you get this these current police dramas now where the police are all kind of the good guys, or it centers around the good guys, and even Brooklyn Nine-Nine is, you know, guilty of this in some ways, in the glorification of police, even as it kind of shines lights on some of the bad things that are happening too. But that's where I think our love of vigilantes come in, because we want this hero who is outside of an organisation which was perceived and shown to be corrupt in most media. And even now that we've got that, you know, the good police now, the stories usually centre around one policeman who within the good police stands apart because they're a little bit wild, because they don't conform, and they play that vigilante kind of character. And so I think we've always been attracted to that character because it's always the separation. And that's why even now we love that private detective character.
Yeah, we want the knight errant.
Yeah. I don't know if what I said made any sense at all.
No, I followed you. Yeah, I followed you. Okay, other examples of sort of PIs and, well, have either of you read The Rivers of London by Ben Aronovich?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, technically, I think he's not really a PI because he's a police constable.
He's not a PI. He's a police constable, as you say. I think it does hit quite a lot of similar tropes in the sense of it being that sort of urban fantasy with one foot in the world of humanity and one foot in the world of magic. And I've only read the first book, in fairness, so I can't really comment on the rest of the series. But I found that was quite interesting as well. And it was an interesting angle to look at, saying that we are going to have someone who is part of the very definitely the human system, and yet he was still drawn into this world of magic, rather like Murphy is in Harry Dresden, in fact, where she's
yeah. And I think with Ben Aronovitch, what really shines through The Rivers of London is his world building. It's superbly well done.
Yes, yeah, definitely. I mean, I have to say that book, I find Punch and Judy quite freaky, so that was actually relatively creepy as well, in my opinion. But yeah, the world building was extremely good.
Yeah, so I must admit, I mean, I thought the book was great, but I did get the impression that the plot was almost secondary to just setting up the world. And Ben Aronovitch was like, look, there's all these shiny things. Let's talk to Rivers.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The fact that I haven't immediately gone and devoured the second book, which I've got, would tend to agree with you there, because ultimately it's plot and character that keeps me invested. I love a brilliantly built world, but something needs to be happening as well.
Mm. Also talking boobies.
Well, yes, there was an element of that as well. What is it with all these male main characters?
Well, you know what? I complained to a male friend about that, and he was like, oh, I hadn't noticed.
Like,
you're such a dude.
Yeah, I said to my boyfriend about Harry Dresden, he's like, right, so basically he's thinking like a 20-something-year-old man. Then I said, seriously? Because I know for a fact you don't think like that.
But your boyfriend isn't a 20-something-year-old man.
Not anymore, but he has been one at one point. He had to be in order to get where he is now.
Yeah, but you're... I'm just pointing out that, to be honest, like, I think maybe the reason I can't complain about it is that Kestrel's surrounded by good-looking men constantly, and also good-looking women, but her general knee-jerk reaction every time she sees someone beautiful is just to go, ah, you bitch.
Yeah, but once again, we're not at the cataloguing body parts stage. I feel like we're going off tangent here a little bit.
No, you know what? I'm going to start cataloguing body parts now. But it's not going to be the body parts you expect. It's going to be livers and kidneys.
Yeah, but how is she going to know? You can start opening people up and go, oh, I like your kidneys. Let's talk.
Yeah, you know what? McBurney, body snatcher.
Body snatcher. Kestrel McBurney goes Hannibal Lecter.
That could be a super creepy speed dating. Is let's look at internal organs to see whether we're compatible.
If anyone did it.
Oh god, yeah. Well, that's a dark alternate universe there for you, Madeline. So
I'm going to stop talking now.
Giving me all of these ideas. But yeah, okay. So actually, this does bring us onto another very salient point, which is that the genre is very much dominated by men in terms of writing, at least in terms of the kind of the popular fiction. Now, I say it's dominated by men because there are actually quite a lot of female writers, but there is still this very kind of sexualized view when it comes to urban fantasy, where if you do have a female main character, she is often quite a fetishized female character. She's powerful, but she's also very beautiful, and there is a kind of a sexual quality that goes the whole way through. Do you agree or disagree?
I agree. When you said the female writers, the first two that came to mind were Kim Harrison and Laura L. Hamilton. Hamilton, I think. And certainly, I gave up on the Mary Gentry series because she just seemed to be shagging Pretty Faye all the time, and that wasn't really what I wanted from those books.
Yeah, same with the Anita Blake Vampire Hunter series, as in about halfway through, it basically turned into porn.
I didn't ever go there because I heard rumours and I thought, you know what, I don't need that.
I mean, obviously it's fine if that's what someone wants to read, but there wasn't much plot apart from the, oh, and this week I'm going to be getting it on with a werewolf kind of thing. Mm. in graphic detail, I will point out.
Of course.
Well, I mean, what other kind of sex scene is there in a book other than one written in graphic detail?
One that's written tastefully.
Yeah, I think the one exception that I can off the top of my head think of is Kelly Armstrong. Because she writes strong female characters, and the books actually have a plot, and although there is sex, it's really not the main focus. I really like her books.
Yeah, I've read a couple. The werewolf one, Stolen and Bitten, and yeah. And Shauna Maguire, actually, she writes the October Day series, and October, or Toby Day, is a single mother, which is already an unusual thing to have as a main character, who works as a PI and is also a knight of a fairy court as well. But when she says knight, she makes a point of saying, I'm a knight in terms of, yeah, I've been knighted, I don't go in wielding a sword, that's for the people who do the action stuff. I just investigate things.
I like her already.
Yeah.
That sounds bloody awesome.
She's great. Actually, I love anything by Shauna Maguire or her alter ego, Myra Grant. She writes excellent, excellent books. And the Toby Day series is brilliant. For a start, it's kind of putting a single mother at front and centre and making her an absolute sort of tigress and really intelligent is a big plus in my book.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, I've got another question for you relating to this. Can either of you guys think of an urban fantasy series where the main character does not have sex within the first one or two books?
No. hang on. Does Peter Grant actually have sex in The First Rivers of London? He thinks about it a lot, but I'm not sure he gets it on with anyone.
No, I don't think he does, but I had to really think then, because he thinks about it so much that I sort of assumed he had at some point, and I just tuned out.
Yeah, I mean, even I can't say, look, my book, because she does have sex in the first book, but it's very minor bit.
To be honest, I'm not saying that it's a bad thing. I'm just, I just feel like we probably do need to, any chance I get, to talk about sex, any chance. and actually its relationship to the genre.
Well, I must admit, I mean, there is a plot reason for why I put it in, but there's almost, I feel there's an expectation
that
there should be something. It doesn't have to be graphic werewolf or vampire kind of.
And again, I'm really making the point that it's not a bad thing. Like, I'm not saying, well, all of these books fail because they've got sex in them. I'm just making a point that it's a common theme that goes throughout. And I think you're right, Laura. I think that there is an expectation to have sex, but I also think that it really goes hand in hand with mystery. And once again, I think that kind of comes down to the whole noir genre as well. Because if you look at, you know, I mean, you don't have to see characters having sex in Agatha Christie.
That might be when they were written.
Also, thank you. Yeah, let's be grateful. Not that I don't think Farrah Hastings would be a great scary, but still no.
God, Miss Marple and the Dance of the Seven Veils.
Yeah, but you don't see that happening.
Octogenarian erotica. Sorry, my brain has gone off piece now completely, so well done.
You're welcome. so you don't get it in that. And I literally do think it is born from that whole kind of noir sort of film. And you always have the PI or the kind of, you know, the broody cop. And they always meet the femme fatale, and there's always sex involved, and normally she dies or betrays him, or, you know, maybe very rarely they both get away with it. And then you also, you know, that then kind of fed into the whole spy genre too. But they are kind of very, very centered. And I do think it is because there is this big relationship between magic, mystery, and sex. Maybe because for so many of the male readers, Sex is magical and mysterious.
That's a very forgiving way of putting it. I think you're on something there, and maybe that's partly why the Harry Dresden series does have all these beautiful women in, because, and why he can't seem to quite get away from them being sexy lamps and really, really attractive and femme fatales, is because it's feeding off this gumshoe noir type background where that's what the women were. So yeah, possibly yeah. This is a genre trope that's carried on. However, Laura has done something a little bit different in Fallible Justice. Are you okay sort of well, I mean, you don't have to give anything away, but Yanya isn't really heterosexual, is she?
No.
And obviously there's more to her character. In fact, I don't think you've identified one way or another, and that's fine, if you don't want to. But what was really nice was there's a tiny bit in there where Yanya is saying to her apprentice Carrion that sometimes it's about people, it's not about gender.
Yeah, I knew very early on that I wanted her to have and have had both male and female lovers, but it almost became a point of pride that I didn't want to define her.
Yeah,
because her sexuality shouldn't be a defining feature, so the readers can make her be whatever they want her to be, whether it's pansexual or bisexual. I don't almost care, not in a bad way, but it doesn't make any difference to me, because for me, she's undefined and she's just who she is and doesn't make any difference.
Yeah. And obviously Madeline was talking about the whole, you know, the character, the private investigator in these sort of series meets the femme fatale and it doesn't go well for them, or, you know, one betrays the other or whatever. And again, you've either deliberately or non-deliberately taken a slight turn on that as well, which you don't have to go into because of spoilers, but it's just to say it's really nice to see variations on the common tropes being sort of nodded to and then ignored, in my opinion, in urban fantasy.
Yeah, it's not always nice to be able to do something slightly different. And I want to say that I had this all planned out and I considered every trope and then I consciously decided to go a different way. But honestly, a lot of it just fell into place because it fitted the story the way it's being written.
Yeah. No, and that's great. And to be honest, I find the same thing when I'm writing. I'd like to say that everything sort of was planned in advance, and quite often it wasn't. And certainly with things like character sexuality and sort of making sure there's representation. But I think the thing is, if you ask yourself those questions just generally as a person and as a writer, then it starts to come out in your writing anyway.
Mm.
Whereas, as we've said, I'm sorry to pick on Jim Butcher.
No, you're not.
No, I am actually, because it's one of those things where I so want to really like and admire you as a writer, but you keep doing things that piss me off. But he does. Perhaps he doesn't ask himself the "is this character gay?" question, for example, or could they be gay? He just makes the assumption that they're heterosexual because partly of the genre it's in, because it's urban fantasy, mystery, noir, or whatever. And yeah, because you don't ask yourself those questions as a writer, then it doesn't therefore come out in your writing, if you follow me.
Yeah.
I think in some ways that's a great shame, because if you're reimagining the world with magic and all these creepy crawlies, you could reimagine it so many different ways. Like, does it have to be so heteronormative?
Yeah.
If you can tolerate mages, can you not tolerate blacks or gays or disabled people or different religions? It just seems unnecessarily restrictive to me.
Yeah, definitely. We haven't lost you, have we, Madeline?
No, sorry. No, I am here. I am here.
I think she's distracted by awesomeness of Jim Butcher.
I'm just seething. Actually, I was nodding, but I realised that's not very helpful.
Well, we can't see you, so.
Yeah, I thought we had a bond, Jules. I thought you could tell. Jeez.
Yeah, but Jim Butcher was in the conversation, and to be honest, with the whole the reader can read what they want, I was kind of expecting Roland Barthes to show up. And
oh no, you summoned him! Oh, here he comes, sliding in. Ugh. Still gooey from his decomposing remains. Oh, it's gross. Anyway, we probably should mention Roland Barthes here as well. Because, yes, we are going to each have different experiences when we're reading it as well. And just as you say, Laura, in kind of leaving your main character's sexuality relatively open, you stated facts. And you know for sure, yes, she's had partners of both male and female gender, but it's kind of up to readers. And on the one side, you know, some people say, no, we do want that proper, you know, we want things to be defined. But on the other side of it, it does leave that nice openness, which means that readers can really take away what they need and what they want from a book. And it's entirely valid. In the same way that I think my experience of reading Jim Butcher is going to be very different to Jules's because of the experiences that we've had, but also, you know, because of the age difference at the time of reading it and the fact that Jules is much better read than me, and she, you know, she was probably also a lot more conscious about certain things than I was. That is going to ultimately affect the way that we see the rest of the series.
And also, I think the more you write yourself, particularly if you're writing in the same genre, the more critical you are of what you read.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which does occasionally kill me when I find plot holes in my favourite author's novels.
Yeah, yeah, you kind of realise you've ruined yourself by doing too much writing.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's also kind of a weird thing when you go back to a series that you really enjoyed and was very informative when you were younger, and suddenly go, wow, actually, I bigged this up a lot in my mind. In some ways, it's kind of therapeutic because you suddenly go, wow, I can actually be a little bit more forgiving with my own writing now. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I haven't managed to get there yet, but it makes
sense. No, me neither. Could you show us how it's done?
You open a book and you're like, wow, this is terrible. I'm a better writer than this.
Oh, I have read books that actually made me within the first two chapters want to write a better book in the same genre just so, because I was so angry at that book.
Yeah, right there with you.
Yeah. I mean, that is why I wrote Kestrel Saga. And I was, you know, I was really, as I said, another reason I really loved Jim Butcher was probably the first time, again, apart from the Percy Jackson books, that I read a series which was written in the first person in that particular style, but definitely kind of for adults rather than for kids. And I just loved it. And it was the first time I suddenly thought, wow, I can write fantasy like that. I can have a character who talks and thinks like me. In other words, 100% sarcastic and, you know, a little angry most of the time. That's allowed. I'm allowed to do that. They don't need to be pleasant people because, wow, Harry Dresden is a good guy, but he's a serious asshole at the same time. And so I suddenly thought, wow, I kind of want to add my voice to this, because Harry Dresden, obviously, very American and male. And I thought, but what about English and female? So actually, you know, that's the point. What kind of, because obviously I haven't read your book, Laura, yet. Can you just tell me, have you gone for first person with this?
Yeah, it's first person present narrative. So Yania, everything is as Yania experiences it.
Right, first person present.
I will say that the present tense sort of becomes invisible within about two paragraphs. Because I'm one of those people where if the first person present isn't well done, then it, I can find it quite jarring. But if it's done well, then it just becomes invisible and you don't notice it.
Yeah, I think first writing in present tense is incredibly difficult because it's very effective if you do it right, but it's very easy to do it wrong. But if Jules's recommendation is there, I'm sure I'll be fine with it. Because usually, if I see present tense, I will leap out of the closest window screaming and weeping. But yeah, when it's done right, it's very successful. And actually, you know, having present tense and first person is something that you do see a fair amount of within the genre, probably because of its immediacy and its intimacy with the main character. Now, that's something that we should probably talk about as well, which is the intimacy of the main character and how these stories tend to be very character driven. And I think that's because, once again, we are trapped very much in this is the story not just about a mystery and things like that, but about a person healing or trying to heal, or maybe even just a person who has been so damaged that they see things in a very, very warped way. And that focus on character is really, really common in mystery books, especially when you have detectives who are a little bit other in some way or not some way. So, you know, even, you know, Hercule Poirot, quite other, Miss Marple, quite other, but we were still quite distanced from them. But then when you have things like Sherlock Holmes, you know, there was a lot centered around him, even though it was very rarely from his point of view. And as we continue to go throughout history, we do get that real kind of focus growing more and more and more, to the point that, you know, I think that's where superheroes came from. And you definitely get that with characters like Batman, with, you know,
Jessica Jones.
Jessica Jones, exactly, yes. We should be talking about if we're talking about, you know, PIs and stuff like that. It's no wonder that we get that first person most of the time. And already, you know, we've been told with your main character, Laura, that this is a character who suffers from chronic pain and has also kind of put themselves in this self-imposed, what's the word?
Exile,
thank you, yes. So instantly, we're seeing things from a different point of view. And skewered is the wrong word, but, you know, it's shifted our point of view. And I think that's probably one of the main centres of the genre. And it's looking at things from a different, often darker point of view.
Yeah, the ones I find really, really work, even if they've got aspects that annoy me, the ones that really work for me are the ones where the character's internal conflict, their quest to find themselves or to find where they belong, or, you know, just to come to peace with the fact that they're a little bit different and don't really fit in with their own people, their own time, where that internal conflict is reflected by the struggle that's going on outside, the mystery that they're actually trying to solve. The best ones in some ways sort of reflect back and forth the character development and the immediate plot. And particularly in something like a series, you see that conflict changing each book very slightly and yet still keeping that quite close relationship where it reflects the internal and the external, in my opinion.
Sorry.
Yeah, and I think that makes it interesting because there has to be some correlation between the internal development of the character and the plot of the book, and they should run parallel, really.
Yeah, definitely. Guys, we've been talking for an hour. I know it doesn't feel like it, but I think we've got to the point where if we just go back to Laura and Fallible Justice, and Laura, you can tell us where readers, who, and our listeners, in fact, can find you on the internet and learn more about your series and your books.
I'm on Twitter. My handle is L Larkso Writer, because someone had already taken Laura Larkso, and that poor person keeps getting tagged on Hullable Justice Reviews. I bet she hates me. And I have a website, which is www.lauralarksobooks.com. And you can find my blog from there, where I ramble on about writing and getting published and about the series, and occasionally share a bit of writing that I've now been press ganged into, actually including one of the books. It's my first reader is very demanding and bossy.
I don't blame them. I would be a lot more bossy about it if I thought I could get away with it.
Well, then, further ado, we should probably get on to our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And oddly enough, I think you know what it's going to be. So, Jules, would you like the honours?
Yeah, I'm recommending Fallible Justice by Laura Larkso. We've talked about it a lot this episode, so you should have been paying attention if you've got to this point. And hopefully you really want to read it. If not, it's a slightly different...
I hope you really want to read it too.
Yeah,
I absolutely definitely really want to read it.
I'm contractually obligated to say it's awesome.
It is awesome. It is awesome. And I'm in no way influenced by the fact that I've been told I'm on the ARC list for the second book, which I really desperately want. I did get to the end of the book and I was like, okay, I need the second one now. The third one. So that's how good it is. You guys should definitely go and check it out. And can we say a big thank you to Laura for coming on our show today? So thanks, and it's been great to have you.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been really awesome, and not just because, you know, talking boobs and dissing them.
No, it's been really, really great having you. And we'd love to have you back. So when your next book is ready and about to emerge into the world.
Oh yeah, can you give us sorry to interrupt, Madeline. Can you give us a little? Can you give us a little hint about Echo Murder?
Jules, most of us haven't read the first book yet. Jesus, you can get your hint after we finish recording.
Please.
So in Echo Murder, a unassuming office worker gets a surprise when the police turn up at his door and tell him that he was stabbed in the West End. But because he's alive and well, the police chalk the first death up to a mage prank. But when the same man dies again, Detective Jamie Manning gets in touch with Yania and asks her to take on the case. And her and Carrion have are trying to find a killer when the same person keeps dying again, and with each death, more of the echo bleeds into reality, and suddenly they have a life to save, and they risk their own in the process.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Jesus Christ. Oh, no. Right.
Tell me that doesn't sound amazing.
It sounds great, okay? Let me read the first one first. Jesus. Thanks very much for coming, Laura. We look forward to having you on the show again. And to all of our listeners, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.